rid of the feds and the cops. They don't know it yet, but they're about to move their show on down the road. Then early in the morning, we start door to door at the small motels. Most of these dumps have less than 50 rooms. I figure two of our men can search one in 30 minutes. I know it'll be slow, but we can't just sit here. Maybe when the cops pull out, the McDears will breathe a little and make a mistake.
You mean you want our men to start searching hotel rooms? Mr. Muralto asked.
DeVasher, there's no way we can hit every door, but we gotta try. Mr. Muralto stood and glanced around the room.
So what about the water? He asked in the direction of Lazarov and DeVasher.
They stared at each other, thoroughly confused by the question.
The water! Mr. Muralto screamed. What about the water?
All eyes shot desperately around the table and quickly landed upon Lazarov.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm confused.
Mr. Muralto leaned into Lazarov's face.
What about the water, Lou? We're on a beach, right? There's land and highways and railroads and airports on one side, and there's water and boats on the other. Now, if the roads are blocked and the airports and railroads are out of the question, where do you think they might go? It seems obvious to me they would try to find a boat and ease out in the dark. Makes sense, don't it, boys?
Every head in the room nodded quickly. DeVasher spoke first.
Makes a hell of a lot of sense to me.
Wonderful, said Mr. Muralto. Then where are our boats? Lazarov jumped from his seat, turned to the wall, and began barking orders at his lieutenants. Go down to the docks. Rent every fishing boat you can find for tonight and all day tomorrow. Pay them whatever they want. Don't answer any questions, just pay them the money. Get our men on those boats and start patrolling as soon as possible. Stay within a mile of shore. Shortly before 11, Friday night, Aaron Rimmer stood at the checkout counter at an all-night Texaco in Tallahassee and paid for a root beer and 12 gallons of gas. He needed change for the call. Outside, next to the car wash, he flipped through the blue pages and called the Tallahassee Police Department. It was an emergency. He explained himself, and the dispatcher connected him with a shift captain.
Listen, Rimmer yelled urgently. I'm here at this Texaco, and 5 minutes ago I saw these convicts everybody's looking for. I know it was them.
Which convicts? Asked the captain.
The McDears. Two men and a woman. I left Panama City Beach not 2 hours ago, and I saw their pictures in the paper. Then I stopped here and filled up, and I saw them.
Rimmer gave his location and waited 30 seconds for the first patrol car to arrive with blue lights flashing. It was quickly followed by a second, third, and fourth. They loaded Rimmer in a front seat and raced him to the South Precinct. The captain and a small crowd waited anxiously. Rimmer was escorted like a celebrity into the captain's office, where the three composites and mugshot were waiting on the desk.
"That's them," he shouted. I just saw them, not 10 minutes ago. They were in a green Ford pickup with Tennessee plates, and it was pulling a long double-axle U-Haul trailer.
Exactly where were you? Asked the captain. The cops hung on every word.
I was pumping gas. Pump number 4, regular unleaded, and they eased into the parking lot, real suspicious-like.
They parked away from the pumps, and the woman got out and went inside. He picked up Abby's composite and studied it.
Yep.
That's her, no doubt. Her hair is a lot shorter, but it's dark. She came right back out, didn't buy a thing. She seemed nervous and in a hurry to get back to the truck. I was finished pumping, so I walked inside. Right when I opened the door, they drove within 2 feet of me. I saw all three of them.
Who was driving? Asked the captain.
Rimmer stared at Ray's mugshot.
Not him. The other one.
He pointed at Mitch's composite.
Could I see your driver's license? A sergeant said.
Rimmer carried 3 sets of identification. He handed the sergeant an Illinois driver's license with his picture and the name Frank Temple.
What direction were they headed? The captain asked.
East. At the same moment, about 4 miles away, Tony Verkler hung up the payphone, smiled to himself, and returned to the Burger King. The captain was on the phone. The sergeant was copying information from Rimmer Temple's driver's license, and a dozen cops chattered excitedly when a patrolman rushed into the office.
Just got a call. Another sighting at a Burger King east of town. Same info. All three of them in a green Ford pickup pulling a U-Haul. Guy wouldn't leave a name, but said he saw their pictures in the paper. Said they pulled through the carry-out window, bought 3 sacks of food, and took off.
It's gotta be them, the captain said with a huge smile.
The Bay County Sheriff sipped thick black coffee from a styrofoam cup and rested his black boots on the executive conference table in the Caribbean room at the Holiday Inn. FBI agents were in and out, fixing coffee, whispering and updating each other on the latest. His hero, the big man himself, Director F. Denton Voiles, sat across the table and studied a street map with 3 of his underlings. Imagine, Denton Voiles in Bay County. The room was a beehive of police activity. Florida state troopers filtered in and out. Radios and telephones rang and squawked on a makeshift command post in a corner. Sheriff's deputies and city policemen from 3 counties loitered about, thrilled with the chase and suspense and presence of all those FBI agents. And Voiles. A deputy burst through the door with a wild-eyed glow of sheer excitement.
Just got a call from Tallahassee. They've got 2 positive IDs in the last 15 minutes, all 3 of them in a green Ford pickup with Tennessee tags.
Voiles dropped his street map and walked over to the deputy.
Where were the sightings?
The room was silent, except for the radios.
First one was at a Texaco Quick Shop. Second one was 4 miles away at a Burger King. They drove through the drive-in window. Both witnesses were positive and gave identical IDs.
Voiles turned to the sheriff.
Sheriff, call Tallahassee and confirm. How far away is it?
The black boots hit the floor.
Hour and a half. Straight down Interstate 10.
Voiles pointed at Terrence and they stepped into a small room used as the bar. The quiet roar returned to Mission Control.
If the sightings are real, Voiles said quietly in Terrence's face, we're wasting our time here.
Yes, sir. They sound legitimate. A single sighting could be a fluke or a prank, but 2 that close together sound awfully legitimate.
How the hell did they get out of here?
It's got to be that woman, Chief. She's been helping him for a month. I don't know who she is or where he found her. But she's on the outside watching us and feeding him whatever he needs.
Do you think she's with them?
Doubt it. She's probably just following closely, away from the action, and taking directions from him.
He's brilliant, Wayne. He's been planning this for months.
Evidently.
You mentioned the Bahamas once.
Yes, sir. The $1 million we paid him was wired to a bank in Freeport. He later told me it didn't stay there long.
You think maybe he's headed there?
Who knows?
Obviously, he has to get out of the country.
I talked to the warden today. He told me Ray McDear can speak 5 or 6 languages fluently. They could be going anywhere.
I think we should pull out, Voiles said.
Let's get the roadblocks set up around Tallahassee. They won't last long if we've got a good description of the vehicle. We should have them by morning. I want every cop in Central Florida on the highways in an hour. Roadblocks everywhere. Every Ford pickup is automatically searched, okay? Our men will wait here until daybreak, then we'll pull up stakes. Yes, sir, Terrence answered with a weary grin. Word of the Tallahassee sightings spread instantly along the Emerald Coast. Panama City Beach relaxed. The McDears were gone. For reasons known only to them, their flight had moved inland. Sighted and positively identified, not once but twice, they were now somewhere else, speeding desperately toward the inevitable confrontation on the side of a dark highway. The cops along the coast went home. A few roadblocks remained through the night in Bay County and Gulf County. The pre-dawn hours of Saturday were almost normal. Both ends of the strip remained blocked, with cops making cursory exams of driver's licenses. The roads north of town were free and clear. The search had moved east. On the outskirts of Ocala, Florida, near Silver Springs on Highway 40, Tony Verkler lumbered from a 7-Eleven and stuck a quarter in a payphone. He called the Ocala Police Department with the urgent report that he had just seen those three convicts everybody was looking for up around Panama City Beach. The McDears. Said he saw their pictures in the paper the day before when he was driving through Pensacola, and now he had just seen them. The dispatcher informed him all patrolmen were on the scene of a bad accident and asked if he would mind driving over to the police station so they could file a report. Tony said he was in a hurry, but since it was somewhat important, he would be there in a minute. When he arrived, the chief of police was waiting in a t-shirt and blue jeans. His eyes were swollen and red, and his hair was not in place. He led Tony into his office and thanked him for coming by. He took notes as Tony explained how he was pumping gas in front of the 7-Eleven, and a green Ford pickup with a U-Haul trailer behind it pulled up next to the store, and a woman got out and used the phone. Tony was in the process, he explained, of driving from Mobile to Miami, and had driven through the manhunt up around Panama City. He had seen the newspapers and had been listening to his radio and knew all about the three McDears. Anyway, he went in and paid for the gas and thought that he had seen the woman somewhere before. Then he remembered the papers. He walked over to a magazine rack in the front window and got a good look at the men. No doubt in his mind. She hung up, got back in the truck between the men, and they left. Green Ford with Tennessee plates. The chief thanked him and called the Marion County Sheriff's Department. Tony said goodbye and returned to his car, where Aaron Rimmer was asleep in the back seat. They headed north, in the direction of Panama City Beach.
Chapter 39. Saturday, 7 a.m. Andy Patrick looked east and west along the strip, then walked quickly across the parking lot to room 39. He knocked gently. After a delay, she asked, "Who is it?" "The manager," he answered. The door opened, and the man who resembled the composite of Mitchell Y. McDear slid out. His hair was now very short and gold-colored. Andy stared at his hair. "Good morning, Andy," he said politely while glancing around the parking lot.
"Good morning. I was kind of wondering if you folks were still here."
Mr. McDear nodded and continued to look around the parking lot.
"I mean, according to the television this morning, you folks traveled halfway across Florida last night."
"Yeah, we're watching it. They're playing games, aren't they, Andy?" Andy kicked at a rock on the sidewalk.
"Television said there were three positive identifications last night, at three different places. Kind of strange, I thought. I was here all night working and being on the lookout and all, and I didn't see you leave. Before sunrise, I sneaked across the highway to a coffee shop just over there. And as usual, there were cops in there. I sat close to them. According to them, the search has been called off around here. They said the FBI moved out right after the last sighting came in, around 4 this morning. Most of the other cops left, too. They're going to keep the strip blocked until noon and call it off. Rumor has it you've got help from the outside and you're trying to get to the Bahamas. Mr. McDear listened closely as he watched the parking lot. What else did they say? They kept talking about a U-Haul truck full of stolen goods and how they found the truck and it was empty, and how nobody can figure out how you loaded the stolen goods into a trailer and sneaked out of town right under their noses. They're very impressed, all right. Of course, I didn't say nothing, but I figured it was the same U-Haul you drove in here Thursday night. Mr. McDear was deep in thought and did not say anything. He didn't appear to be nervous. Andy studied his face carefully. You don't seem too pleased, Andy said. I mean, the cops are leaving and calling off the search. That's good, ain't it? Andy, can I tell you something?
Sure.
It's more dangerous now than before. Andy thought about this for a long minute, then said, How's that? The cops just wanted to arrest me, Andy. But there are some people who want to kill me. Professional killers, Andy. Many of them. And they're still here. Andy narrowed his good eye and stared at Mr. McDear. Professional killers? Around here? On the strip? Andy took a step backward. He wanted to ask exactly who they were and why they were chasing him, but he knew he wouldn't get much of an answer. He saw an opportunity. Why don't you escape?
Escape?
How could we escape? Andy kicked another rock and nodded in the direction of a 1971 Pontiac Bonneville parked behind the office.
Well, you could use my car.
You could get in the trunk, all three of you, and I could drive you out of town.
You don't appear to be broke, so you could catch a plane and be gone. Just like that.
And how much would that cost? Andy studied his feet and scratched his ear. The guy was probably a doper, he thought, and the boxes were probably full of cocaine and cash, and the Colombians were probably after him. That'd be pretty expensive, you know. I mean, right now, at $5,000 a day, I'm just an innocent motel clerk who's not very observant. Not part of nothing, you understand. But if I drive you out of here, then I become an accomplice, subject to indictment and jail and all that other crap I've been through, you know? So it'd be pretty expensive.
How much, Andy?
$100,000. Mr. McDear did not flinch or react. He just kept a straight face and glanced across the beach to the ocean.
Andy knew immediately it was not out of the question.
Let me think about it, Andy. For right now, you keep your eyes open. Now that the cops are gone, the killers will move in. This could be a very dangerous day, Andy, and I need your help. If you see anyone suspicious around here, call us quick. We're not leaving these rooms, okay?
Andy returned to the front desk.
Any fool would jump in the trunk and haul ass.
It was the boxes, the stolen goods. That's why they wouldn't leave.
The McDears enjoyed a light breakfast of stale pastries and warm soft drinks. Ray was dying for a cold beer, but another trip to the convenience store was too risky. They ate quickly and watched the early morning news. Occasionally a station along the coast would flash their composites on the screen. It scared them at first, but they got used to it. A few minutes after 9 a.m. Saturday,
Mitch turned off the television and resumed his spot on the floor among the boxes. He picked up a stack of documents and nodded at Abby, the camera operator. The deposition continued. Lazarov waited until the maids were on duty, then scattered his troops along the strip. They worked in pairs, knocking on doors, peeking in windows, and sliding through dark hallways. Most of the small places had two or three maids who knew every room and every guest. The procedure was simple, and most of the time it worked. A goon would find a maid, hand her a $100 bill, and show her the composites. If she resisted, he would continue giving money until she became cooperative. If she was unable to make the ID, he would ask if she had noticed a U-Haul truck, or a room full of boxes, or two men and a woman acting suspicious or scared, or anything unusual. If the maid was of no help, he would ask which rooms were occupied, then go knock on the doors. "Start with the maids," Lazarov had instructed them. "Enter from the beach side. Stay away from the front desks. Pretend to be cops. And if you hit pay dirt, kill them instantly and get to a phone." Devasher placed four of the rented vans along the strip near the highway. Lamar Quinn, Kendall Mahon, Wally Hudson, and Jack Aldrich posed as drivers and watched every vehicle that passed. They had arrived in the middle of the night on a private plane with 10 other senior associates of Bendini, Lambert, and Locke. In the souvenir shops and cafes, the former friends and colleagues of Mitch McDear milled about with the tourists and secretly hoped they would not see him. The partners had been called home from airports around the country, and by mid-morning they were walking the beach and inspecting pools and hotel lobbies. Nathan Locke stayed behind with Mr. Meralto, but the rest of the partners disguised themselves with golf caps and sunglasses and took orders from General Devasher. Only Avery Tolar was missing. Since walking out of the hospital, he had not been heard from. Including the 33 lawyers, Mr. Meralto had almost 100 men participating in his private little manhunt. At the Blue Tide Motel, a janitor took a $100 bill, looked at the composites, and said he thought he might have seen the woman and one of the men check into two rooms early Thursday evening. He stared at Abby's sketch and became convinced it was her. He took some more money and went to the office to check the registration records. He returned with the information that the woman had checked in as Jackie Nagel and paid cash for two rooms for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. He took some more money, and the two gunmen followed him to the rooms. He knocked on both doors. No answer. He unlocked them and allowed his new friends to inspect them. The rooms had not been used Friday night. One of the troops called Lazarov, and 5 minutes later, Devasher was poking around the rooms looking for clues. He found none, but the search was immediately constricted to a 4-mile stretch of beach between the Blue Tide and the Beachcomber, where the U-Haul was found. The vans moved the troops closer. The partners and senior associates scoured the beach and restaurants, and the gunmen knocked on doors. Andy signed the Federal Express ticket at 10:35 and inspected the package for Sam Fortune. It had been shipped by Doris Greenwood, whose address was listed at 4040 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee. No phone number. He was certain it was valuable and for a moment contemplated another quick profit. But its delivery had already been contracted for. He gazed along both ends of the strip and left the office with the package. After years of dodging and hiding, Andy had subconsciously trained himself to walk quickly in the shadows, near the corners, never in the open. As he turned the corner to cross the parking lot, he saw two men knocking on the door to room 21.
The room happened to be vacant, and he was immediately suspicious of the two. They wore odd-fitting matching white shorts that fell almost to their knees, although it was difficult to tell exactly where the shorts stopped and the snow-white legs began. One wore dark socks with battered loafers. The other wore cheap sandals and walked in obvious pain. White Panama hats adorned their beefy heads. After 6 months on the strip, Andy could spot a fake tourist. The one beating on the door hit it again. When he did, Andy saw the bulge of a large handgun stuck in the back of his shorts. He quickly retraced his quiet footsteps and returned to the office. He called room 39 and asked for Sam Fortune. "This is Sam." "Sam, this is Andy at the desk. Don't look out, but there are two very suspicious men knocking on doors across the parking lot."
"Are they cops?"
"I don't think so. They didn't check in here."
"Where are the maids?" Sam asked.
"They don't come in till 11 on Saturday."
"Good. We're turning off the lights. Watch them and call when they leave."
From a dark window in a closet, Andy watched the men go from door to door, knocking and waiting, occasionally getting one to open. 11 of the 42 rooms were occupied. No response at 38 and 39. They returned to the beach and disappeared. Professional killers. At his motel. Across the strip, in the parking lot of a miniature golf course, Andy saw two identical fake tourists talking to a man in a white van. They pointed here and there and seemed to be arguing. He called Sam. "Listen, Sam, they're gone, but this place is crawling with these people."
"How many?"
"I can see two more across the strip. You folks better run for it."
"Relax, Andy. They won't see us if we stay in here."
"But you can't stay forever. My boss will catch on before much longer."
"We're leaving soon, Andy. What about the package?"
"It's here."
"Good. I need to see it. Say, Andy, what about food? Could you ease across the street and get something hot?" Andy was a manager, not a porter.
But for $5,000 a day, the Seagull's Rest could provide a little room service.
"Sure. Be there in a minute."
Wayne Terrence grabbed the phone and fell across the single bed in his Ramada Inn room in Orlando. He was exhausted, furious, baffled, and sick of F. Denton Voiles. It was 1:30 p.m. Saturday. He called Memphis. The secretary had nothing to report except that Mary Alice called and wanted to talk to him. They had traced the call to a payphone in Atlanta. Mary Alice said she would call again at 2 p.m. to see if Wayne—she called him Wayne—had checked in. Terrence gave his room number and hung up. Mary Alice. In Atlanta. McDear in Tallahassee, then Ocala. Then no McDear. No green Ford pickup with Tennessee plates and trailer. He had vanished again. The phone rang once. Terrence slowly lifted the receiver. "Mary Alice," he said softly.
"Wayne, baby, how'd you guess?"
"Where is he?"
"Who?"
Tammy giggled. "McDear, where is he?"
"Well, Wayne, you boys were hot for a while, but then you chased a wild rabbit. Now you're not even close, baby. Sorry to tell you."
"We've got 3 positive IDs in the past 14 hours.
"Better check them out, Wayne. Mitch told me a few minutes ago he's never been to Tallahassee. Never heard of Ocala. Never driven a green Ford pickup. Never pulled a U-Haul trailer. You boys bit hard, Wayne. Hook, line, and sinker."
Terence pinched the bridge of his nose and breathed into the phone.
"So how's Orlando?" she asked. "Gonna see Disney World while you're in town?"
"Where the hell is he?"
"Wayne, relax, baby. You'll get the documents."
Terence sat up. "Okay, when?"
"Well, we could be greedy and insist on the rest of our money. I'm going to pay phone Wayne, so don't bother to trace it, okay? But we're not greedy. You'll get your records within 24 hours, if all goes well."
"Where are the records?"
"I'll have to call you back, baby. If you stay at this number, I'll call you every 4 hours until Mitch tells me where the documents are. But, Wayne, if you leave this number, I might lose you, baby. So stay put."
"I'll be here. Is he still in the country?"
"I think not. I'm sure he's in Mexico by now. His brother speaks the language, you know?"
"I know."
Terence stretched out on the bed and said to hell with it.
Mexico could have them as long as he got the records.
"Stay where you are, baby. Take a nap. You gotta be tired. I'll call around 5 or 6.
Terence laid the phone on the nightstand and took a nap. The dragnet lost its steam Saturday afternoon when the Panama City Beach police received the 4th complaint from motel owners. The cops were dispatched to the Breakers Motel, where an irate owner told of armed men harassing the guests. More cops were sent to the strip, and before long they were searching the motels for gunmen who were searching for the McDears. The Emerald Coast was on the brink of war. Weary and hot, DeVasher's men were forced to work alone. They spread themselves even thinner along the beach and stopped the door-to-door work. They lounged in plastic chairs around the pools, watching the tourists come and go. They lay on the beach, dodging the sun, hiding behind dark shades, watching the tourists come and go. As dusk approached, the army of goons and thugs and gunmen and lawyers slipped into the darkness and waited. If the McDears were going to move, they would do it at night. A silent army waited for them. DeVasher's thick forearms rested uncomfortably on a balcony railing outside his Best Western room. He watched the empty beach below as the sun slowly disappeared on the horizon. Aaron Rimmer walked through the sliding glass door and stopped behind DeVasher.
"We found Tolar," Rimmer said.
DeVasher did not move.
"Where?"
"Hiding in his girlfriend's apartment in Memphis."
"Was he alone?"
"Yeah. They iced him.
Made it look like a robbery."
In room 39, Ray inspected for the 100th time the new passports, visas, driver's licenses, and birth certificates. The passport photos for Mitch and Abby were current, with plenty of dark hair. After the escape, time would take care of the blondness. Ray's photo was a slightly altered Harvard Law School mugshot of Mitch, with the long hair, stubble, and rough academic looks. The eyes, noses, and cheekbones were similar after careful analysis, but nothing else. The documents were in the names of Lee Stevens, Rachel James, and Sam Fortune, all with addresses in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Doc did good work, and Ray smiled as he studied each one. Abby packed the Sony video camera into its box. The tripod was folded and leaned against the wall. 14 video cassette tapes with stick-on labels were stacked neatly on the television. After 16 hours, the video deposition was over. Starting with the first tape, Mitch had faced the camera, raised his right hand, and sworn to tell the truth. He stood next to the dresser with documents covering the floor around him. Using Tammy's notes, summaries, and flowcharts, he methodically walked through the bank records first.
He identified over 250 secret accounts in 11 Cayman banks. Some had names, but most were just numbered. Using copies of computer printouts, he constructed the histories of the accounts. Cash deposits, wire transfers, and withdrawals. At the bottom of each document used in his deposition, he wrote with a black marker the initials MM and then the exhibit number. MM1, MM2, MM3, and so on. After exhibit MM1485, he had identified $900 million hiding in Cayman banks. After the bank records, he painstakingly pieced together the structure of the empire. In 20 years, more than 400 Cayman corporations had been chartered by the Maraltos and their incredibly rich and incredibly corrupt attorneys. Many of the corporations owned all or pieces of each other and used the banks as registered agents and permanent addresses. Mitch learned quickly that he had only a fraction of the records and speculated on camera that most documents were hidden in the basement in Memphis. He also explained, for the benefit of the jury, that it would take a small army of IRS investigators a year or so to piece together the Maralto corporate puzzle. He slowly explained each exhibit, marked it carefully, and filed it away. Abby operated the camera. Ray watched the parking lot and studied the fake passports. He testified for 6 hours on various methods used by the Maraltos and their attorneys to turn dirty money into clean. Easily the most favored method was to fly in a load of dirty cash on a Bendini plane, usually with two or three lawyers on board to legitimize the trip. With dope pouring in by land, air, and sea, U.S. Customs cares little about what's leaving the country. It was a perfect setup. The planes left dirty and came back clean. Once the money landed on Grand Cayman, a lawyer on board handled the required payoffs to Cayman Customs and to the appropriate banker. On some loads, up to 25% went for bribes. Once deposited, usually in unnamed numbered accounts, the money became almost impossible to trace. But many of the bank transactions coincided nicely with significant corporate events. The money was usually deposited into one of a dozen numbered holding accounts, or super accounts, as Mitch called them. He gave the jury these account numbers and the names of the banks. Then, as the new corporations were chartered, the money was transferred from the super accounts to the corporate accounts, often in the same bank. Once the dirty money was owned by a legitimate Cayman corporation, the laundering began. The simplest and most common method was for the company to purchase real estate and other clean assets in the United States. The transactions were handled by the creative attorneys at Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, and all money moved by wire transfer. Often the Cayman Corporation would purchase another Cayman Corporation that happened to own a Panama Corporation that owned a holding company in Denmark. The Danes would purchase a ball bearing factory in Toledo and wire in the purchase money from a subsidiary bank in Munich. And the dirty money was now clean. After marking Exhibit MM4292, Mitch quit the deposition. 16 hours of testimony was enough. It would not be admissible at trial, but it would serve its purpose. Terrence and his buddies could show the tapes to a grand jury and indict at least 30 lawyers from the Bendini firm. He could show the tapes to a federal magistrate and get his search warrants. Mitch had held to his end of the bargain. Although he would not be around to testify in person, he had been paid only $1 million and was about to deliver more than was expected. He was physically and emotionally drained and sat on the edge of the bed with the lights off. Abby sat in a chair with her eyes closed. Ray peeked through the blinds. We need a cold beer, he said.
Forget it, Mitch snapped.
Ray turned and stared at him. Relax, little brother. It's dark and the store is just a short walk down the beach. I can take care of myself.
Forget it, Ray. There is no need to take chances. We're leaving in a few hours. And if all goes well, you'll have the rest of your life to drink beer.
Ray was not listening. He pulled a baseball cap firmly over his forehead, stuck some cash in his pockets, and reached for the gun.
Ray, please, at least forget the gun, Mitch pleaded.
Ray stuck the gun under his shirt and eased out the door. He walked quickly in the sand behind the small motels and shops, hiding in the shadows and craving a cold beer. He stopped behind the convenience store, looked quickly around, and was certain no one was watching, then walked to the front door. The beer cooler was in the rear. In the parking lot next to the strip, Lamar Quinn hid under a large straw hat and made small talk with some teenagers from Indiana. He saw Ray enter the store and thought he might recognize something. There was a casualness about the man's stride that looked vaguely familiar. Lamar moved to the front window and glanced in the direction of the beer cooler. The man's eyes were covered with sunglasses, but the nose and cheekbones were certainly familiar. Lamar eased inside the small store and picked up a sack of potato chips. He waited at the checkout counter and came face to face with the man, who was not Mitchell McDear, but greatly resembled him. It was Ray. It had to be. The face was sunburned and the hair was too short to be stylish. The eyes were covered. Same height, same weight, same walk.
How's it going? Lamar said to the man.
Fine.
You?
The voice was similar. Lamar paid for his chips and returned to the parking lot. He calmly dropped the bag in a garbage can next to a phone booth and quickly walked next door to a souvenir shop to continue his search for the McDears.
Chapter 40. Darkness brought a cool breeze to the beach along the strip. The sun disappeared quickly, and there was no moon to replace it. A distant ceiling of harmless dark clouds covered the sky, and the water was black. Darkness brought fishermen to the Dan Russell Pier in the center of the strip. They gathered in groups of three and four along the concrete structure and stared silently as their lines ran into the black water 20 feet below. They leaned motionless on the railing, occasionally spitting or talking to a friend. They enjoyed the breeze and the quietness and the still water much more than they enjoyed the occasional fish that ventured by and hit a hook. They were vacationers from the north who spent the same week each year at the same motel and came to the pier each night in the darkness to fish and marvel at the sea. Between them sat buckets full of bait and small coolers full of beer. From time to time throughout the night, a non-fisherman or a pair of lovebirds would venture onto the pier and walk 100 yards to the end of it. They would gaze at the black, gentle water for a few minutes, then turn and admire the glow of a million flickering lights along the strip. They would watch the inert, huddled fishermen leaning on their elbows. The fishermen did not notice them. The fishermen did not notice Aaron Rimmer as he casually walked behind them around 11. He smoked a cigarette at the end of the pier and tossed the butt into the ocean. He gazed along the beach and thought of the thousands of motel rooms and condos. The Dan Russell Pier was the westernmost of the three at Panama City Beach. It was the newest, the longest, and the only one built with nothing but concrete. The other two were older and wooden. In the center, there was a small brick building containing a tackle shop, a snack bar, and restrooms. Only the restrooms were open at night.
It was probably a half mile east of the Seagull's Rest. At 11:30, Abby left room 39, eased by the dirty pool, and began walking east along the beach. She wore shorts, a white straw hat, and a windbreaker with the collar turned up around her ears. She walked slowly with her hands thrust deep in the pockets like an experienced, contemplative beachcomber. 5 minutes later, Mitch left the room, eased by the dirty pool, and followed her footsteps. He gazed at the ocean as he walked. Two joggers approached, splashing in the water and talking between breaths. On a string around his neck and tucked under his black cotton shirt was a whistle, just in case. In all four pockets, he had crammed $60,000 in cash. He looked at the ocean and nervously watched Abby ahead of him. When he was 200 yards down the beach, Ray left room 39 for the last time. He locked it and kept a key. Wrapped around his waist was a 40-foot piece of black nylon rope. The gun was stuck under it. A bulky windbreaker covered it all nicely. Andy had charged another $2,000 for the clothing and items. Ray eased onto the beach. He watched Mitch and could barely see Abby. The beach was deserted. It was almost midnight Saturday, and most of the fishermen had left the pier for another night. Abby saw three in a small cluster near the restrooms. She slipped past them and nonchalantly strolled to the end of the pier, where she leaned on the concrete railing and stared at the vast blackness of the gulf. Red buoy lights were scattered as far as she could see. Blue and white channel lights formed a neat line to the east. A blinking yellow light on some vessel inched away on the horizon. She was alone at the end of the pier. Mitch hid in a beach chair under a folded umbrella near the entrance to the pier. He could not see her, but had a good view of the ocean. 50 feet away, Ray sat in the darkness on a brick ledge. His feet dangled in the sand. They waited. They checked their watches. At precisely midnight, Abby nervously unzipped her windbreaker and untied a heavy flashlight. She glanced at the water below and gripped it fiercely. She shoved it into her stomach, shielded it with the windbreaker, aimed at the sea, and pushed the switch 3 times. On and off, on and off, on and off. The green bulb flashed 3 times. She held it tightly and stared at the ocean. No response. She waited an eternity, and 2 minutes later flashed again. 3 times. No response. She breathed deeply and spoke to herself. "Be calm, Abby. Be calm. He's out there somewhere." She flashed 3 more times, then waited. No response. Mitch sat on the edge of the beach chair and anxiously surveyed the sea. From the corner of an eye, he saw a figure walking, almost running from the west. It jumped onto the steps of the pier. It was the Nordic. Mitch bolted across the beach after him. Aaron Rimmer walked behind the fisherman, around the small building, and watched the woman in the white hat at the end of the pier. She was bent over, clutching something. It flashed again, 3 times. He walked silently up to her. "Abby." She jerked around and tried to scream. Rimmer lunged at her and shoved her into the railing. From the darkness, Mitch dived head first into the Nordic's legs, and all three went down hard on the slick concrete. Mitch felt the gun at the Nordic's back. He swung wildly with a forearm and missed. Rimmer whirled and landed a wicked smash to Mitch's left eye. Abby kicked and crawled away. Mitch was blind and dazed. Rimmer stood quickly and reached for the gun, but never found it. Ray charged like a battering ram and sent the Nordic crashing into the railing. He landed 4 bullet-like jabs to the eyes and nose, each one drawing blood. Skills learned in prison.
The Nordic fell to all fours, and Ray snapped his head with four powerful kicks. He groaned pitifully and fell, face first. Ray removed the gun and handed it to Mitch, who was standing now and trying to focus with his good eye. Abby watched the pier. No one. "Start flashing," Ray said as he unwound the rope from his waist. Abby faced the water, shielded the flashlight, found the switch, and began flashing like crazy.
"What are you gonna do?"
Mitch whispered, watching Ray and the rope.
"Two choices. We can either blow his brains out or drown him."
"Oh my God," Abby said as she flashed.
"Don't fire the gun," Mitch whispered.
"Thank you," Ray said. He grabbed a short section of rope, twisted it tightly around the Nordic's neck, and pulled. Mitch turned his back and stepped between the body and Abby. She did not try to watch.
"I'm sorry.
We have no choice," Ray mumbled almost to himself. There was no resistance, no movement from the unconscious man. After 3 minutes, Ray exhaled loudly and announced, "He's dead." He tied the other end of the rope to a post, slid the body under the railing, and lowered it quietly into the water. "I'm going down first," Ray said as he crawled through the railing and slid down the rope. 8 feet under the deck of the pier, an iron cross brace was attached to two of the thick concrete columns that disappeared into the water. It made a nice hideout. Abby was next. Ray grabbed her legs as she clutched the rope and eased downward. Mitch, with his one eye, lost his equilibrium and almost went for a swim. But they made it. They sat on the cross brace, 10 feet above the cold, dark water. 10 feet above the fish and the barnacles and the body of the Nordic. Ray cut the rope so the corpse could fall to the bottom properly before it made its ascent in a day or two. They sat like three owls on a limb, watching the buoy lights and channel lights and waiting for the Messiah to come walking across the water. The only sounds were the soft splashing of the waves below and the steady clicking of the flashlight. And then voices from the deck above. Nervous, anxious, panicked voices searching for someone. Then they were gone.
"Well, little brother, what do we do now?" Ray whispered.
"Plan B," Mitch said.
"And what's that?"
"Start swimming."
"Very funny," Abby said, clicking away.
An hour passed. The iron brace, though perfectly located, was not comfortable.
"Have you noticed those two boats out there?" Ray asked quietly. The boats were small, about a mile offshore, and for the past hour had been cruising slowly and suspiciously back and forth in sight of the beach.
"I think they're fishing boats," Mitch said.
"Who fishes at 1 o'clock in the morning?" Ray asked.
The three of them thought about this. There was no explanation. Abby saw it first and hoped and prayed it was not the body now floating toward them. "Over there," she said, pointing 50 yards out to sea. It was a black object, resting on the water and moving slowly in their direction. They watched intently. Then the sound, like that of a sewing machine.
"Keep flashing," Mitch said.
It grew closer. It was a man in a small boat.
"A-Banks,"
Mitch whispered loudly. The humming noise died.
"A-Banks," he said again.
"Where the hell are you?"
came the reply.
"Over here, under the pier. Hurry, damn it!"
The hum grew louder, and A-Banks parked an 8-foot rubber raft under the pier. They swung from the brace and landed in one joyous pile. They quietly hugged each other, then hugged A-Banks.
He revved up the 5-horsepower electric trolling motor and headed for open water.
"Where have you been?"
Mitch asked. "Cruising," Abanks answered nonchalantly.
"Why are you late?"
"I'm late because I've been dodging these fishing boats filled with idiots in tourist clothes posing as fishermen."
"You think they're Maraltos or Fibbies?" Abby asked.
"Well, if they're idiots, they could be either one."
"What happened to your green light?"
Abanks pointed to a flashlight next to the motor.
"Battery went dead."
The boat was a 40-foot schooner that Abanks had found in Jamaica for only $200,000. A friend waited by the ladder and helped them aboard. His name was George, just George, and he spoke English with a quick accent. Abanks said he could be trusted. "There's whiskey, if you like. In the cabinet," Abanks said. Ray found the whiskey. Abby found a blanket and lay down on a small couch. Mitch stood on the deck and admired his new boat. When Abanks and George had the raft aboard, Mitch said, "Let's get out of here. Can we leave now?"
"As you wish," George snapped properly.
Mitch gazed at the lights along the beach and said farewell. He went below and poured a cup of scotch. Wayne Terrence slept across the bed in his clothes. He had not moved since the last call 6 hours earlier. The phone rang beside him. After 4 rings, he found it.
"Hello."
His voice was slow and scratchy.
"Wayne, baby, did I wake you?"
"Of course."
"You can have the documents now. Room 39, Seagull's Rest Motel, Highway 98, Panama City Beach. The desk clerk is a guy named Andy, and he'll let you in the room. Be careful with them. Our friend has them all marked real nice and precise, and he's got 16 hours of videotape. So be gentle."
"I have a question," Terrence said.
"Sure, big boy. Anything."
"Where did he find you? This would have been impossible without you."
"Gee, thanks, Wayne. He found me in Memphis. We got to be friends, and he offered me a bunch of money."
"How much?"
"Why is that important, Wayne?" "I'll never have to work again."
"Gotta run, baby. It's been real fun."
"Where is he?"
"As we speak, he's on a plane to South America. But please don't waste your time trying to catch him."
"Wayne, baby, I love you, but you couldn't even catch him in Memphis.
Bye now."
She was gone.
Chapter 41. Dawn. Sunday. The 40-foot schooner sped south with full sails under a clear sky. Abby was in a deep sleep in the master suite. Ray was in a scotch-induced coma on a couch. Abanks was somewhere below, catching a nap. Mitch sat on the deck, sipping cold coffee and listening to George expound on the basics of sailing. He was in his late 50s, with long, gray, bleached hair and dark, sun-cured skin. He was small and wiry, much like Abanks. He was Australian by birth, but 28 years earlier had fled his country after the largest bank heist in its history. He and his partner split $11 million in cash and silver and went their separate ways. His partner was now dead, he had heard. George was not his real name, but he'd used it for 28 years and forgotten the real one. He discovered the Caribbean in the late 60s, and after seeing its thousands of small, primitive, English-speaking islands, decided he'd found home. He put his money in banks in the Bahamas, Belize, Panama, and, of course, Grand Cayman. He built a small compound on a deserted stretch of beach on the Little Cayman and had spent the past 21 years touring the Caribbean in his 30-foot schooner. During the summer and early fall, he stayed close to home. But from October to June, he lived on his boat and hopped from island to island. He'd been to 300 of them in the Caribbean. He once spent 2 years just in the Bahamas. There are thousands of islands, he explained.